I'm just going to go ahead and start. And if people come in, they come in, right? Good plan. I guess a lot of you don't know me because I haven't been in any of these conferences before. This is my first time. I'm actually an academic of the ancient Near East, a scholar of the ancient Near East. And for me, the Bible is new. My work is several thousand years before then in cuneiform. But on the other hand, I've been an active professional psychic medium person since the mid-1970s. So in this book, my book, I combine these two skills. And actually, this is the Nautilus Gold Award. It won for 2013 the Gold Award for Grief, Death, and Dying. And it was hailed by Publishers Weekly as the most important work on the enigma of death since Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. So I just thought you should know that exists. I do tend to read talks anyway. It's an academic habit. But I have an extra excuse that I'm on bad jet lag. And in this environment of darkness and temperature control, I don't know what my circadian rhythm just didn't get anywhere near where it should be. So I'm going to mostly talk by reading. Is that all right? I'll make sure to look up. And I want to thank you all for being here. I really appreciate it. I was afraid that after lunch on the last day, there wouldn't be a soul in this room. Okay. You know, 30 years ago, bereavement counseling suggested or sort of forced grievers into breaking ties with the departed. And at least that much has changed today. Now they want people to suggest keeping ties with the departed in terms of writing letters or writing journals, things of that sort. Come on in, Diane. And these coping strategies are a little bit better, but they really aren't enough. And from the people I've talked to who are bereavement counselors have said that bereavement counseling is the hardest thing to break through, to make a change in someone's life. The truth is, the most effective methods are also the most controversial in maintaining ties to after-death communication. And direct, unmediated contact with a departed loved one can instantly alleviate grief, and that's just the plain truth. It can also resolve deeply rooted problems in your relationship with the departed. It can furthermore resolve problems that are anchored in the way that person died, especially if it was traumatic or unexpected. Lack of resolution with the departed greatly exacerbates grief, and it loads the natural pain of mourning with feelings of helplessness, anger, guilt, shame, fear, abandonment, suicide longings, depression, and severe and extreme loneliness. And most of us bunch all that into grief, but they don't properly belong to it. So the point is to start to tease out what doesn't really belong to your grief through resolution. And then grief is easy to handle. A strong component of grieving is helplessness. We're brought on by mainstream social beliefs, first, that we're taught we can't know whether the deceased survived. We're taught that we can't communicate with the deceased to find out. If anyone can communicate with the deceased, it's going to be a professional, like a medium. But the studies show that people who go to mediums to communicate with the deceased actually get a surge of desperate grief afterwards because they've lost the dead person a second time. They've lost that departed a second time. They can't communicate themselves with the departed, so they're cut off again. Therefore, in my work as a medium, what I do is to make sure you connect directly with the deceased. And it has been quite a ride. And so far, I've had about 98% success rate in all these years. And people are even developing an ability to go into the landscapes of the deceased, participate in their constructions. It's jaw-dropping. The second problem that we have that induces helplessness with grief is because we're taught that death is a failure. And it's a failure that we could do nothing to stop. So we just change these two beliefs that we can't communicate, we can't know whether they survive, and we change the belief that we have death is a failure. That will change the face of grief totally. It'll change the world. Most of you know a main reason why the deceased come to us anyway is because they want resolution. I think that's pretty clear to everybody here. They usually want to demonstrate their remorse. Sometimes they'll wait for you to forgive. They don't directly ask for forgiveness. They don't even try to explain. They just show the intensity of the remorse, and the forgiveness seems to be automatic on our side. They often want to tell us that they've recovered fully from whatever they died from, and which is extremely important to many people. Once we allow that contact to take place, grief gets stripped with all these secondary distresses, and grief unburdened by these unwanted and usually conflicting emotions tends to be deep, sharp, and short-lived. I've worked with thousands of people through this process, and some of them actually report, once they start developing what I'm calling today a living relationship, they report embarrassment at how well they're doing. I think it's something that's very enculturated that we should feel as horrible as we do. There's still, of course, longing for the person's physical presence. That's something that's undeniable. You still have to face the vacant spot at the dinner table or the empty food bowl on the floor. But, you know, that kind of grief gets to be manageable, especially since you know that you can switch and be with that departed person when you need to. Nevertheless, allowing to fully mourn is crucial for assimilating the corporal loss of someone dear in our lives. And suppressing deep grief, which a lot of people do for various reasons, feeling it's an indulgence or whatever stoicism they're following, we are cheating ourselves on the healing that grieving can bring. We're also setting up a pattern of emotional dishonesty. And emotional dishonesty is the one thing that will really block communication with the departed. Suppressed anger is another big blocker. And boy, that's hard to work with, to get somebody past the anger, to get them into communication. But worse still is numbness when there's no emotional movement whatsoever. The people who seem to me to suffer the most are clearly parents who've lost a child, especially when that child committed suicide. And that's mainly my focus today. I work a great deal with suicides. And just to be very brief about this, so many people say, well, what happens to suicides after they die? Anything can happen. It depends entirely on the person and the circumstances. But nevertheless, that parental grief is already intense. It escalates alarmingly when the child, they can't find the child, they can't make the resolution. Those who commit active suicide, such as shooting themselves or throwing themselves in front of a train, tend to be extraordinarily good communicators, and they really want to communicate with you. Those who are more passive suicide victims, like through drug overdose, are not very good, and sometimes they can get locked in hallucinations. So they require a lot of work. You know, I just want to mention that death by throwing yourself in front of a train is becoming a fad in the subways in New York. And I also want to mention that suicide now outnumbers car accidents for deaths in the United States. So what's going on? So I'm going to tell you a story about a man and his 18-year-old son. I'm going to call his son Patrick. Patrick committed suicide by shooting himself in the chest. And the father, Steve, went absolutely numb. But it wasn't the father who first got in touch with me. It was the child's grandfather. And he didn't know very much about his grandson because they lived over 1,000 miles apart. But the grandfather and I worked together and got an enormous amount of information, all of which I, of course, taped. And finally, the grandfather got around to telling his son was like a biker, you know, with the tattoos and the whole business, and he had no belief in the afterlife whatsoever, and even less, if you can have less than no belief, of after-death communication. But the grandfather had got up the nerve to share this tape with him, and the son, the father of the deceased child, went crazy and wanted a session. So we got a session, the three of us on teleconferencing. And Patrick, the dead boy, just wouldn't stop. I mean, it was almost one of those situations where you don't have enough time to get it all in because the information comes all at once. Now, you know my objective is to get Steve, the father, into communication. Well, what happened in this case was that his son's need to speak to the father was so strong, that did it. I didn't have to do anything. The father went right into communication himself, and then he started feeling this trembling sensation. He started feeling, well, I'll tell you in a minute. The boy talked about his concerns for a cousin of his, what was wrong with the cousin. He talked about his estranged mother, what to do for her. He talked about his girlfriend, which is one of the reasons he committed suicide, who he believed at the time was pregnant. And he talked about the drugs he took before he shot himself. And there's a lot of other things he talked about, but these were things the grandfather didn't know, but the father could corroborate. So the father had been blaming himself for this child's suicide because it was the father who introduced his son to guns. So Patrick's main message was, give up the guilt. If I hadn't died from the gunshot, I would have died from, he was a racer. You notice he had a four-wheeler that he raced, he would have died that way. When this message came through, and it came through not just by me, but also by the emotional experience of the father, this is when the trembling started, and he couldn't speak. And finally, he started trying, sort of croaked into the phone, it was a teleconference, said, I feel like all of my insides are shaking apart. What is that? That's the numbness breaking up. That's the release of this tremendous pent-up energy. And some people never get that release. Some people go right from there into suicide after a death. You know, Patrick was not really nice to his father either. I mean, in a certain way, he was very loving. There was a lot of love going on there. But he also gave his father a good talking to about his father's life habits, which were clearly going to lead to an early death, about the problems with the father's wife, especially that she was doing everything for everyone. And I was really involved. So anyway, I talked to him the next day, or contacted me the next day, and he said that he felt as though he had had an operation. That he'd been through an operation. And I've heard this a lot of times. I hear things of burdens coming off, lightened feelings, or operation. These are not exactly metaphors. Because what actually had been removed was the beginning of a terrible disease. And the dead can and do have the ability to remove those as thought forms. I've even seen them come in to a person's body and pull something out. And you know what? Healing takes place, physical healing takes place after such an event. It's quite extraordinary to see. There was a certain point during this three-way conference with the grandfather, the father, the dead son, and myself, where the son wanted to talk to his father about the father's relationship with his own father. And at that moment, the grandfather, who was listening in, lost connection with the phone. It just went off, and we couldn't get him at all. And as soon as that message stopped, he got back online. So there's a lot of control going on here, yeah? So when this happened, now you can say this marked the beginning of Steve's recovery. Marked the beginning of a healing process that was not just emotional, not just spiritual, but also physical. A growing number of people are realizing the extraordinary therapeutic value of after-death communication. You know, I don't know if many of you are aware of this, but there are new therapies out now called induced after-death communication by a reputable therapist. Most of them are trauma-trained. Anybody who's interested, I'll give you the websites for that after our talk. And these therapies have been set up to treat acute grief, suicide longing after a loss, and death-related post-traumatic stress disorder. That's hefty. Although the methods differ, all of us who work in this area, agree on two things. Can you close, Eloise, can you close that door? First is that cures can be achieved in a matter of minutes. Now, by contrast, bereavement counselors say that, well, it might take a year or it may never happen. There are cases of post-traumatic stress disorder that have been standing for 20, 30, 40 years of intrusive nightmares, night sweats, suicide longings that disappear in 20 minutes. Now, the actual real therapy time is a matter of a few seconds. Okay, keep that in mind. The second thing we all agree on is that without a doubt, the best bereavement counselors around are the dead themselves. And that's the truth. I probably don't have to convince any of you here of the validity of after-death communication, do I? Most of you had an experience? Oh, come on. Patricia. Well, the truth is, whether you know it or not, everyone has communication with the dead. It's the world's best-kept secret. My work as a medium is just to bring this inborn natural ability to the surface so people can communicate when they want to, not having to wait for it, not having to pray for it, just sit down and do it. The Afterlife Encounters Survey, which was done in the late 90s, it was the most extensive and broadest-based survey of its kind. It found that 72% of its respondents believed that they had either felt the presence of the dead or communicated with them. Now, if this survey is representative of all the United States population, it only means that 210 million people in the United States have had an encounter. What this survey doesn't include, now here's the academic side of me with this little thing here, children, I don't need this. The dying who routinely have deathbed visits, people who encounter loved ones in dreams, nor does it include what I call subtle signs, which I'll go into later, and communication with deceased pets. Believe me, there's a lot of that is not included. The statistics are based on spontaneous encounters alone, which means that they exclude the living's active pursuit for communication, such as which takes place in prayer, which takes place in inner conversations, when you're talking to the dead at the gravesite, to the dead's picture, to the urn. It excludes the ever-growing number of mediums, and everybody in this room is one, let me tell you. It excludes therapists who are working in this field. And it excludes direct encounters through instrumental transcommunication, in particular electronic voice phenomena. So let's add all of this up. Now, the mental intrusion, something I'll talk about in a minute, are the most prominent. So if we add all of this up, what do you think the percentage really is?
98 to 100.
Thank you. And you think you're really in that 2%?
No.
Okay, better. I feel better about you now.
Thank you. There's hope.
Okay. Spontaneous encounters are frequent in the first year of mourning, especially the first couple of days. They usually happen when a person is relaxed, when they're not expecting it, often while dreaming or they're doing something else like cooking or driving a car. But they can also occur because of stress, and this is something that is underplayed in the spiritual communities really at large. Stress is one of the biggest promoters of all psychic activity. Just ask a near-death experiencer. Think about it. There are institutionalized ways of inducing stress in almost any religion you can name, fasting 40 days and 40 nights. A lot of the Indian cultures, in order to reach a sacred vision, induce stress or bodily harm. Thirst, whatever it is, so that they could reach these visions. So stress is your catapult, for the most part, which comes directly after death and makes after the death of someone near you and primes you for communication. So who appears? I like this. I'm not going to read this all out loud. I'm just going to point to a few things here. This one here, where am I? Spouse is 6%. Whoa! This is cultural. This is America. This is an America of lots of divorces. If you took this here and applied it to Japan, 92% of widows polled in Japan had communication with their late spouses. So it's a huge difference. So all of these things are mediated by culture. But I've noticed huge amounts of grandparents, pets, really frequent. And when I do after-death work with people, I often see a pet in the landscape and say, well, where's the white dog coming from? And he goes, oh, my God, I haven't seen that dog. I died when I was seven. You know, so they're around. Those pets stay around, and they often stay with relatives of yours who are on the other side. So if it's so common, and now we've got it up, thanks, Patricia, to 98%, if it's so common, then why aren't we all doing it? Why aren't we more aware of it? So the main reason is quite obvious. It's the fear of death, right? It's a fear that's so strong, it really does hold our society captive. Anything to do with death, such as the bone-chilling idea of conjuring the dead, is avoided in our private lives. Now, doesn't mean we don't feast on it in books, news, TV. But think of words like, cheerful words like the dead, which I use. Corpse, grave, casket, funeral. I mean, really, they're all so bleak. They're sinister. They're dark. The only words I can think of or only terminology that actually has some light in it is near-death experience. You know, people see that as light-filled. That's got to change. Both the fear of conjuring the dead and the fear of death itself stem primarily from ancient Judaism, and I don't want to step on anybody's feet, but don't forget, I am a scholar in this field. So please bear with me. This happened during the reforms of King Josiah in the 7th century BCE. Before then, ancient Israelites had the same afterlife beliefs and practices as anybody else in that general area of the ancient Near East, especially Mesopotamia. They were very close. Death was seen as a natural outcome of life, and the afterlife admitted everyone. In Israel, it was Sheol. Mesopotamia, we just call it the netherworld. There was no judgment, and there was no exclusion. Close proximity with the dead was a common practice, and we see this archaeologically in household shrines where your ancestors were there. It shouldn't be called ancestor worship. You know, with ancestor worship, you don't get letters saying, hey, you know, dead, my dead father, I've been doing all this stuff for you and all these rituals for you. Can't you do this for me? There's a lot of bartering that goes on. Burials were also often under the household floors, kept the dead near you. Daily relationships were quite common that took place through ritual, induced dreams, letter writing, incantations, and so on. And there's one very charming Mesopotamian incantation text which gives you the formula for a salve that you put on your face so the dead can see you better. And I really want to make that happen. I'll translate it for you and we'll see if it works. So during Josiah's reign, mourning cults were curtailed, and necromancy, isn't that a cheerful word, that's communicating with the dead, was outlawed, and it was punished by pain of stoning. Death, okay? The reason for this was this mandate. This is a forming cult. This is a cult that's centralizing in Jerusalem. And it tried to eliminate other gods. It didn't mean that there weren't other gods. It only meant that you should honor only one. And the dead were considered Elohim, which means the divine or gods. Now, in antiquity, there were lots of different kinds of gods. There's lots of different kinds of divinities. But these Elohim were a big problem to this forming cult, this forming Yahweh cult. Yahweh meaning Jehovah. So they outlawed it. And by doing that, they closed the gates of the afterlife. In the later creation myth, and it is later, it probably was written after the exile, death is no longer even a natural process, a natural outcome of life, but a punishment for disobedience. No post-mortem reunion with the divine would be expected in this context. Yahweh was called the God of the living and dwelled in the heavens the same way as the Olympian gods did. And many gods dwelled in the heavens, or they're called queen or king of heaven or whatever. Mortals were not admitted to these heavenly spheres, only one or two. Yeah? In the centuries to come, even the official stance of the temple in Jerusalem, in particular the Sadducees, who were the temple officials, this official stance, which we know from Josephus, a Jewish Roman historian, that there was no afterlife. This is a huge problem in ancient Judaism, and one of the ways it got solved was through the introduction of apocalypticism. Okay? And that's what Paul and Jesus both taught. And in apocalypticism, there also isn't any real death. You just go to sleep. The righteous awake at the end of days to resurrect in their bodies. The unrighteous are in a sleep time awaiting pain and usually extinction. It depends on which sect you're working with. So there was really no death here. There's still denial of death. And the ultimate aim of the apocalypse is the elimination of death altogether. So what we have here is a lot of denial of death as a natural process. And we have a lot of denial of another unbodily place where a person survives, where the personality survives. Because survival was in a resurrected body. Now, Judeo-Christian inheritance is not the only thing that is forcing a fear of death on our society. It's not the only thing that spreads it. Almost every sector in our society spreads it, and most of them shamelessly exploit it. Certainly you can see that with the news and entertainment industry, and I think most of you have realized by now that the medical, pharmaceutical, and insurance industries also do that. And these are things that I discuss at length in my book, especially this sort of psychotic relationship we have with death, where at home it's not spoken about, but we feed on it as entertainment. It's like a repetitive nightmare that we keep throwing out. I mean, it is really strange. On the news, everything's about death, and they maximize it, spectacular deaths, but look at all the crime shows, the crime novels, the crime movies, or movies where, 280 people are mowed down by one hero. It never stops. The only areas I found at the foundations that don't have this fear at the foundations are mathematics and the creative arts, namely the fine arts and music. And what's interesting to me is that's in these areas is where I see the dead working the most. That's what they're manipulating or playing with, music, art, and they do that in several dimensions at once, which makes it quite different from what we think we're doing, but we're also doing it in several dimensions at once. The difference is we're not conscious of it. Now, nearly all scientists will tell you that survival after death is a fiction. We've accepted that, except some really wonderful physicians who wouldn't say that. When the material body dies, all of you dies, okay? At the same time, the same scientists have dematerialized matter. So we now know that if I took all the atoms out of Marion's body here, and I took all the space out of the atoms in her body, just took the space out, the amount of matter that would be left would be a microscopic dot and a small microscopic dot. So theoretically, the only thing that separates us from the dead is that microscopic dot. And even that dot is in constant flux. So, and then science also has this infinite number of universes that are intermixed with our own, yeah? It has this multiverse theory. And not one of them, of this astronomical near infinite number, is reserved for the dead. Don't ask me. Their professional and private ridicule is why they won't go there. But I think it's only a matter of time before they break down. Many people dismiss after-death communication as fantasy or wishful thinking. And I'm going to tell you about a woman who, in demonstration or an anecdote, that can't be wishful thinking. It's a woman I'm going to call Joan. Suddenly she had a visit of her son, and her son's grandfather came to her. She was overwhelmed, and the son looked brilliant and beautiful and healthy and vibrant, and the grandfather was gleaming and smiling, and the grandfather says to his daughter, "It's okay, honey. I've got him now. He's safe." And a minute later, she gets doorbell rings, and there's the police there that her son had died in a fatal car accident. Okay. She sees her son as he is now, vibrant. Certainly she's going to start shifting to these bad pictures of the mangled body in the car accident, but what would her grief have been like if she hadn't had that encounter? It had been practically inconsolable. Despite all the resistance in the general population, not thankfully in this crowd, about after-death communication, it really is on the rise, and this is something I have certainly noticed in my 40 years of practice. It's just unbelievable, and the interest in it is just so high, and the people's ability to do it is extraordinary. Now, why is that? Most of us think it has to do with that we're just, you know, in that sort of astrological time or whatever, where we're spiritually opening up, but not really. That's not the whole picture, because our main art in Western world is technology. That's really the art of today. And technology, especially communication technology, is one of the biggest teachers. And the whole thing really did start with the invention of the simple telephone. Now, when Alexander Graham Bell introduced the telephone publicly for the first time, this was in the Philadelphia convention, the audience went crazy. They thought he was conjuring a ghost. I mean, there was a lot of fear in the audience. And then, for some reason, Bell used Hamlet's soliloquy that the other guy read, the person on the phone that no one could see was reading Hamlet's soliloquy, which is, of course, when Hamlet talks to the skull about death. So the awareness of the similarity between the telephone and after-death communication was already in place at its invention. And still today, the telephone, either as metaphor or as a physical device, is the most involved of all things with after-death communication. People have conversations with dead people on the phone, and the phone may not even be working. So I think by now we're all kind of used to talking to disembodied voices from who may be anywhere on the earth, right? We're all used to that. But cyberspace, too, this idea of collapsed dimensions, this idea that you're only one page away from where you need to be, that's also a big part of the training ground. I had a very reliable psychic once told me that I was going to go into a period, a really strong period of chat rooms. I've never done a chat room in my life, and I never will. So I was disappointed. She's almost always right. Well, I went into a period of intense after-death communication. It was nonstop for 6 months. Even the best psychic couldn't see the difference between a chat room and after-death communication. That's how closely allied they are. There's also good reason to believe, and this is something that I'm developing and looking into, is that our constant exposure to electricity and electronics is making us more sensitive to subtle electrical impulses. Now, so what? Well, the truth is, all perception is about the translation of subtle electrical impulses. Telepathy is a subtle electrical impulse. Everything is. And generally, they're coming in probably from virtual realities. So this, I think, is probably the biggest turning. This is creating the tipping point for why we're developing in this area. Of course, the media's treatment of it, which is usually bizarre, I must say. Mediums always look like they're getting brain damage when they have a vision. but the flowering of consciousness studies, in particular near-death experience studies, which has probably taken it the furthest from all afterlife studies, they're all helping to validate after-death communication. So that environment, that more permissive environment, is a key factor for why there's so many people in this room after lunch. The main reason, of course, is because I think we're beginning to realize that it's an inborn ability. We all are telepathic, and telepathy combined with a focused intention is all it takes to do after-death communication. If we were not telepathic, we would have no language, we would have no civilization, a mother could not communicate with her child, and prayer would be meaningless. Think about it. Think about all the things that we do where we assume telepathy. And anybody wants the research on telepathy in the average human, come to me. I have tons of references where it's proved. So the point is to make you more aware of this own ability and to consciously use it. So I'm just going to give you a few hints now. This part you might feel a little dense. If you remember one or two things about it, that's enough. Okay? So the first one is a sense of presence. I actually wouldn't put that first. I would put mental intrusions first, but just to be classical, I'll use this. This is similar to a sense of being stared at. Mental intrusions, huge important. That's abrupt changes of ideas. That's a birdie, little birdie told me. I don't know why I came to see you now. Inwardly hearing music, songs or lyrics, huge. Happens to me all the time. I have all of my dead friends trained to have a certain song. And you'll start listening to a song in your head and thinking, wow, what's that mean? And then hold still and you'll realize the lyrics are telling you something. Or the song itself has significance. It's amazing how often it comes through music. Sudden inspiration. Just knowing an answer to something that's bothering you. Visual perceptions. Mostly you should do that inside your brain, called internalization, not look for them outside, but you might experience a kind of visual smokiness, or it'll look like a cubist painting breaking up space, or digital problems on your TV, you know, it starts to go into little blocks. Audible impressions, such as the sound of a footstep or your name being called, actually are the hardest ones to open up into communication. Smells, perfume, tobacco smoke, ammonia, touch, could be an embrace, coolness, thickness in the air, electrical phenomena all over the place. Things that never worked or are broken start working again. Twitter, fax Twitter is going off. It can be crazy. The lights blowing out or flickering. I've even known of an instance where a locked door started up, a locked car door, locked car started up. App ports can occur under other physical phenomena. That's when something just shows up, a picture on the floor of the deceased that had been locked in the attic for years, flowers under a windshield wiper. Now this one here is my most important tingling sensation. This one is the one that I make sure my students really learn. They learn how to experience what's going on in their bodies, in their skin, to know, because this electrical presence will give you a kind of a goosebumpy feeling. Now that goosebumpy feeling actually has a lot of information in it. So when you start to feel a tingling, you got to really use it because you're in the presence of someone who's dead. Another thing most people don't know, which is certainly most pertinent to what we're talking about today, is grief waves. If you feel a sudden surge of grief and you don't know where it's coming from the person you're grieving for who's right there. Almost always. So, what are you going to do when you feel one of these subtle signs? Most people brush them off, think they're imaginary. And most of us, when we do have them, who don't necessarily believe they're imaginary, we're too astonished to do anything about it. But any of these signs can be used to launch into a two-way conversation. So I'm going to give you little tips on what to do when that happens. Let's say you're grieving, and you're crying, and you're weeping, and you're feeling rotten, and you want to kill somebody, and you know you feel abandoned, and all that. Go still. Focus on where you first perceive the sign. Like if you feel it on the right, you feel it on the left, just let your attention go there for a minute. Close your eyes and in your mind start to look for a face, images of any kind or messages of any kind. Usually it's going to come in our day and age in pictures. 200 years ago it was mostly words or audio. And this is important to go into your mind's eye instead of trying to find something outside of you, like a 3D image or something, because when it gets internalized, the telepathy kicks in and it works better. It works faster. You can have longer communication. And what you see, especially if it's the face of the departed, will look a lot like a visual memory. Except if you notice that with visual memories, you don't always see the whole face. And in this case, too, that face will move, it will express itself, and it will respond to questions, and it will show you their state of mind. If you don't get that picture right away, just form one in your mind's eye. Once you get a picture, get and hold that person's attention. Now, this is, again, a kind of a metaphor. What you're doing when you get and hold that person's attention is that you're creating a brainwave synchronicity, and that will allow the telepathic contact take place. What I do as a medium is to step in and make that synchronicity happen. I'm very aggressive. All right? So you hold the person's attention. That's really, really important. And you start talking. You talk out loud. But you do it out loud because it helps keep momentum going. You ask questions. And you know what? You can wait for an answer. You can just wait. And they'll go yes or no or whatever. Sometimes you actually hear words. Sometimes they'll show you whole bunches of things which you have to interpret. But it's a good thing to articulate whatever you pick up and ask for confirmation. I'm getting the feeling that you just met my grandmother. Is that true? And then here comes grandma. Okay. So making contact happen is largely the same. In other words, not waiting for spontaneous, but making it happen on your own. It's largely the same, but there are two really important differences. One is you have to have strong intention, a definite need. I mean, this casual thing, well, I know, I'm just kind of curious, what's he doing? That is not going to produce good after-death communication, not casual curiosity. And then the second is that you have to proceed from your strongest, most genuine emotion, no matter what it is, if it's rage, fear, guilt, sorrow, or love. This is very different from what most people in our field teach. But I found out many years later that this is, in fact, the conditions and clinical tests that make things work. So I am not off here. The worst thing you can do is to go into a meditative modality. Yeah, and do that and just screen out all of your emotions. Forget it. Get raw and pour out to the dead whatever it is you need to pour out. I'm going to skip some stuff here. Okay. As I already mentioned, what we understand is grief has many components that don't properly belong to it. Many of them are symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, such as shock, intrusive memories, dwelling on the last moments, nightmares, despair, depression, numbness, and suicide longing. Now, ADCs have been known to eliminate any of these symptoms. Intrusive memories is what I want to talk about now because it's the most common, especially for bereaved parents or those who are close to someone who died traumatically. These memories are usually intolerable, and usually they are about the last moment, the last dying breath, the last time you saw the body lying mangled in the street, or whatever it is. And they're painful, and you know they just show up. You can stop these intrusive memories cold by recalling that the last moments of the dead's life, these last moments, are insignificant to them. If they remember these moments at all, they remember it a little bit like getting over an illness, like when you had the mumps at the age of 4 or something, because they're in a state of continuity. So they don't care about their last moments, or rarely do, unless it's a murder that's been unsolved. And if it's an accident, very often they don't feel it at all, they just pop out of their bodies. So if you find yourself fighting back shock and tears when the memory of a death intrudes, immediately switch to images of how your loved one is now, right in the afterlife, whole and impossibly vibrant. And you'll begin to feel glad for them, and you probably will even feel a little envious because they're certainly doing better than you are. Now, the departed rarely feel grief because for them there is no separation, right? They maintain this idea of continuity from one life to the next. We don't, but we need to learn to do that in order to recover. I want also to address another thing that is not often spoken about. It's what I call obsessive grief. And that's when a mourner has the illusion that through grief, his or her connectedness with the departed is achieved. All right? Obsessive grievers believe that if their grief is interrupted, even for a very short period of time, that connection will be irreparably broken. What they're doing is obsessing over a person that once was, not the person who is now. It's a little like grieving for, say, your spouse when he was 4 and ignoring when he was 5 up to 85, right? It says you've time stopped. You're believing in something that is just a moment in time and not what actually is. Now, obsessive grieving is also a kind of possessiveness for the deceased as they once were. And it's the one thing that does indeed bother the dead. Obviously, the dead don't use grief to keep connected with us, so why should we? Usually, obsessive grief breaks up when there is a connection made, but the problem, of course, with obsessive grievers is they don't want it to break up. So they don't want communication. And I'll give you a demonstration now of a couple who came to see me from Singapore. Their only child, a 3-year-old boy, had died a few months before they saw me. He was hit by a truck crossing the street with his nanny. No one saw the truck coming, and the nanny was unharmed. What was even stranger was that the day before, playing in a city park, he's running around singing to trees, "I'm going to die, I'm going to die, I'm going to die." He never stopped. And the mother took a cell phone video of this and brought it with her when she visited me. It was heartbreaking. But the weird thing is the child seemed happy. So we started this session, the father was there, and he had virtually no belief in any of this, but he was going along for it for the wife. And he was deeply depressed, and he was clearly an obsessive griever, and he blocked everything so badly because he wouldn't let anybody get in there and help. Because if he lost that grief, he lost his son in his mind. So we had to ask him to leave. Now, the mother had read my book, so she had tried the instructions in here for after-death communication, and it didn't work, and I'll tell you why in a minute. Certainly not my fault. But anyway, so we got back to work, the mother and myself, and found out why the contact was blocked. And that's because this child, usually when a child dies, even an infant, even an aborted child, if you see them in the afterlife, they're usually considerably older almost immediately. And this one was still 3 years old, and he was completely focused on this little red truck toy that he had, which his mother told me was his favorite in life. He was avoiding us because he was expecting recrimination. He hurt his parents. He had done a bad thing, and he was afraid they were mad at him. And that's the reason why he was avoiding contact, and that's the reason why the mother couldn't get to him. So once she understood this, she was very, very much relieved. And he did tell us that he never felt the truck hit him at all. He left before the truck hit him. This is very common. So a few weeks later, I worked with a mother again via Skype. She was back in Singapore. She managed to stay in touch with her child all during this time, and she was thrilled by his rapid growth. In fact, we both saw him as a late teen at this point, and it must have been this communication which alleviated him of it being blamed, because the mother worked really hard in saying, "No, honey, I love you. It's not your fault." This child was moving. He was so awake and so alive to the magic around him and the magic within him. It was... on the phone, you could hear the sobbing, tears coming out of her at the joyfulness of her son. She developed a living relationship, meaning that she was in contact with him almost daily. And that's what I want for everybody, that we can have that contact. It doesn't have to be a big knock-you-down thing, but just a little hello, how are you, checking in. It's really an amazing journey. She had a vivid dream, too, that she told me about a week ago, I suppose, in which this child, there was her husband and the child and herself were all in this dream. And she was, again, streaming with tears because she saw their son run to the father and throw his arms around him. And it was an event for her, which the father refused. So what the father has is a dead, mangled, bloody body, and what she has is a living son. And there is no hope for this marriage. Okay. Mothers are surprisingly successful in developing living relationships. And it really is the best possible response to a major loss. They erase intrusive memories. They transform grief into euphoria. They assuage, if not eliminate, loneliness. And often, and we've seen a lot of this weekend, lead to a new joyful life path of discovery. Interaction with our late loved ones as they really are without the fear of death, because we don't know who we are if we're carrying the fear of death. That's a big one. That they're impossibly aware, loving, compassionate, and accountable is a life-changing thing. As the departed discover their true selves, their newfound openness, their lovingness, their playfulness, their unpretentious wisdom and profound desire to help are downright infectious. We start to acquire these abilities too. We acquire these values. Ongoing contact with them lets us realize we have become a member of a family that is charged with the best qualities of human nature. This is really important with more than a few superhuman gifts, right? There's no better therapy than to realize that your real parents are these amazing immortals, and that will shift your perspective of yourself so fast. No, 20 years of therapy can't do it, but the dead can. And I'm here to tell you that without a doubt, they want you to know who they really are. They want you to see it. Knowing that relationships between the living and the dead continue to grow and improve would certainly transform the way we die and the way we live. Death would no longer be regarded as the ultimate enemy or as an end, but as a miraculous, creative turning point in the life of the eternal self. The spiritual powers of the dying, which are huge, including things like their wondrous deathbed visions, would reveal the exalted essence of humanity. We're all geniuses when we dream. And I can even foresee a future in which family, friends, and caregivers participate in joy and reverence around the deathbed in that expanded moment, because that moment is expanded, it's spacious, it's thick, those portals are open, and we all feel it. You know, there are more and more people doing this. More and more people seeing what they call shared death experiences. They're seeing the body leave. More and more people are seeing the dead people who are coming to visit. And actually, these abilities are quite easy. It's just a matter of focus. So, living relationships put us face to face with our own immortality. If we were truly to understand the nature of our personal immortality, we would let go of petty stresses. We would be freer to be our authentic selves. We would take more risks, which we do, the more authentic we become. We'd be more creative, certainly much more playful, and we wouldn't grab so hard at life. When we as a society arrive at the recognition of what immortality really means, grief for the loss of a person's bodily presence will be characteristically sharp, deep, and mercifully short-lived. Perhaps one day, when our connection with the departed is normalized, grief itself will be a thing of the past. That's it, folks. Any questions? Oh, God, why'd you bring that one up?
I'm sorry, but is he still available for this living relationship with the dead?
The truth is, and this I explained very thoroughly in the book, we're working with a dimension outside of time. You don't vacate a personality to become another one. It's all simultaneous. You are in the afterlife, and you are incarnated. In fact, most people in this room have incarnations walking around now on the earth, contemporary to you. It's not at all the way it's been presented as climbing the ladder of evolution up spiritually. It's not at all the way it's presented as past lives into becoming an old soul at the end. We're not talking about a time trajectory here. It doesn't exist. All of these incarnations occur at the same time, simultaneously, the difference in time zone is more psychological than it is about time. And there are even theories in science where time is all scientific theories in which time is all simultaneous, too. They call it the block time theory. So we're getting there. You bet. And I have. I will tell you a story. There's a woman I know. She is an incarnation of me. She came to me for past life readings. I had to throw her out. She said, why? I said, because they're all my past lives. I was so shocked. I never threw anybody out except this woman. We got close and we started seeing that we were married and we were each other's children, blah, blah, blah. And this went on for a while. I kind of lost touch with her when I was in graduate school. And about 10 years before I met her, I had a very significant trip into the future where I met this guy, Bernard, who's my future incarnation. And he looks at me and he says, oh, you finally figured it out, huh? I mean, that's how stupid we are. I don't care how great any of us is in this area. We're all really in the Stone Age of our abilities. And so anyway, I've met with Bernard here and there, and he's given me a lot of information. 20 years after that incident, this woman, Denise, who's, you know, an incarnation, we're in incarnations of each other, called me and said, I got to talk to you right away. I said, okay, I'll come. So I came, and she said, I just met my future life. And I said, yeah, okay, tell me about it. His name is Bernard. And I keep thinking, what is going on in Bernard's head? He's got these two nutty women in there that he's conversing with. But think about that. Think of how much schizophrenia will change. Think about also being able to recognize that many people come down, there's too much energy for one body. There's a lot of limitations being in this body. Instead of pushing at them, we really should enjoy them. You know, think of a baby who licks table legs. That's enjoying this reality. And to get more into that place is the best thing to do. But we have to understand that consciousness is vastly more flexible than we now realize or are willing to accept. Thanks for the question.
I can relate to everything what you said. I was a child. May I contact you?
Sure. I do a lot of phone work. Huge amounts. I'll give you my card. Yeah, and there's also in the back of the book is a website where you can contact me too if you just have the book. So that's answered. That's an easy question. Yeah, that can happen. Sometimes people just report it in their arms or in their feet. For me, it's a pouring down. And, you know, I just taught a workshop in Austria, and we hadn't even started. We were like 1 hour into just the opening introduction on a Friday night. And this guy's talking about, almost everybody in there wanted to do after-death communication, and that's, you know, only one of the things that I do with these people. But that was, again, this is the focus of today. And so some guy's talking about this wife that he wants to contact, and you see the eyes of people in the room suddenly opening up because they're feeling the presence of it. So they were already doing it. And there's a charming moment. There was a man that I knew. This is in France. And he had a friend who did enormous amounts for him as he was dying and afterwards. And she's very, no belief in afterlife or anything like that. And we were saying goodbye to each other on the street in Paris. And I started saying something, and then I immediately started channeling. I said, I want to say I'm so grateful for what you did. And, of course, I knew it was our friend Gustav, and I was holding her hands when I did this. This is on the street, cars. And her eyes start filling up with tears, and they're huge. And she goes, Julia, what's happening to me? What's happening to my body? I said, Gustav is here. It can be so strong, it really almost will knock you off your feet. And on the other hand, it can be just very mild. Sometimes when you feel inspiration, goosebumps, you know, you got to wonder if that's just inspiration or if there's somebody behind it. Excuse me? Oh, yeah, no, that's brilliant. Yeah, okay. It's really electrical, you know, for the most part. No, I have a doctorate. I taught at Columbia.
Well, are there schools and training for
leadership? No, not official ones. But people like myself, there are a number of them who are teaching. The difference is I know people who have a 3-year course in mediumship, and these people cannot still do mediumship, and I work with them for 20 minutes. You know what the difference is? Because I believe everybody's got it, and a lot of teachers don't really want you to have it. And I'm sorry to say that's the truth. They don't want you to see, and they don't want you to have it. I'm happy to work myself out of a job. And my belief is so steadfast that it seems to spread it. And it only takes me 5 to 10 minutes private, if person's in real need, to do it. Yeah.
About 3 years ago, I had a friend, and all of a sudden we didn't talk to each other. Something happened, I don't even remember. But one time I saw her walking on Fifth Avenue in New York, and she was walking robotically. And
yeah.
I wanted to, there she is, I want to say I'm sorry and everything, but I just saw her pass by. And then she went on, and she was with somebody, so I said maybe I shouldn't talk to her because she's going to say something bad about me. Well, anyway, a week later, I decided to call her. And I said, Barb, I'm sorry, could you call me? And I gave the number in case she forgot. Well, her daughter called me. And she said that she had died a month before.
Yeah.
And while I was talking to the daughter, there was this wind. My apartment in New York is, the window is way over there, so I don't know where the wind
is. No, that's the wind comes, yeah.
Where the hell is the wind coming?
How did
that wind come?
Okay, listen, most of the time they're trying to get our attention. All of these things I talked about, those subtle signs, they're trying to get your attention. If... Like there was one time with an ammonia flooding up the apartment, ammonia smells. I had two people sitting in there coughing, gagging, their eyes were watering. I didn't smell it. I smelled nothing. Why? It's because I was already in contact with that dead person. They're like waving flags. And we're going, oh, wow, that's interesting. I'm just imagining it. And then they have to find another flag to wave. So cold air, sure. Absolutely, but they're not always that talented, and don't also don't get a false picture. Not everybody is in good shape on the other side either, and sometimes they can't even find other people who are dead. Sometimes they'll come to us to ask to help make bridges, and then you start to get into sort of almost like constellation therapy on the other side. It's really fascinating what can be done. Any other questions? Yeah.
In the early days of psychical research, seances, apparitions, physical mediumship, that kind of thing is very popular. What's your feeling about all that?
I'm sorry, it's gone. In the atomic age wiped all that out. When everything was about science, wiped it all out. But there is a little bit of physical mediumship. Yeah, it's been a revival now, certainly, but the caliber is nowhere near what was going on then. These people, and there's a group in Germany, can't think of the name of the circle, but they're producing ectoplasm. They worked 7 years to make this happen. And what we're doing now is everybody's a medium, but professional. That scares me, really, because you need some discrimination. You need a lot of discipline to do this, to really help be helpful to people without making things worse. But what these guys were doing back in England and back in America and before the war or during the war was so spectacular that sometimes the defense ministries during the war had to interfere because they were getting boats, submarines, crashes or sinking before it even happened, and certainly the ministry didn't want that out in the public. So one of them actually had to be put in jail to keep her silent. And we just don't have this now. These were deep trance mediums mostly. It may be that now it's a gift for everyone. It won't be that intensity where you spit out 13 pages of technological information from different sources, people who died in the same drop of a blimp, for instance. But perhaps it should be everyone's thing now. I don't know. But I long for that. I long for those days.
The SPR report on the skull.
Yeah. That's another group that worked a long time.
Yeah.
It worked a long time to get to where it was.
Yes, it did.
So I think that's a basic difference. We want instant results now. Yeah. The Last Frontier, Exploring the Afterlife and Transforming Our Fear of Death. That's my main target, transforming the fear of death.
Is that the only book?
The only book of this type. I have a lot of academic publications, and believe me, you don't want them.
No. No, it would be too complicated.
Yeah, it's in academic jargon. Okay, thanks for so many people coming and for your attention on full stomachs. It's not so easy. So thank you very much.